Mornings are better with a warm beverage, even for Latter-day Saints. Meet Postum, the ideal coffee alternative and proud sponsor of This Week in Mormons podcast. Spot it on the coffee aisle at Smith's Grocery or at your local nearby store. Can't locate it? No worries. Order it at Postum.com. Explore delicious recipes to tailor your Postum experience. Start your day off right with Postum.
Welcome, everybody, to This Week in Mormons with your hosts, Matt and Melissa.
Good morning. Hello. Good day. Good afternoon. Good evening. Thanks for listening.
Today, we have a very special guest with us. His name is John Curtis. He represents Utah's 3rd Congressional District, and he was nice enough to join us to talk about all things Mormon culture, Mormon life. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing well. Happy to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, for sure.
Go ahead, Melissa.
Well, John, I know you as just a human being who lives in the same state as you, but I really don't know anything about you. So, you know, why don't you just give us your quick bio and then we'll pull some things from there.
Okay. Grew up in Salt Lake City. Met my wife, Sue, at Skylines Junior Prom. That was our first date.
Wow. I love it.
A long time ago. We've been married 41 years.
Quick interruption. Do you remember the theme song for your prom?
It was probably a Stairway to Heaven would be my guess. That was a big deal back in, I'll hate to admit it, 1978 is when I graduated.
Awesome.
My wife and I went to BYU. She went to University of Utah. I spent some time with BYU's semester abroad in Israel, served a mission in Taiwan. Came home. My wife and I were married about a year after I came home. We lived in Southern California, lived in Richmond, Virginia, loved both of those experiences. But I had an entrepreneurial bug, and so I came back to Utah and with some partners was part of a company called Action Target. And we built shooting ranges all over the world. Just an amazing, amazing business. We sold that, and that's what I was looking kind of for my next gig. So I ran for the mayor of Provo. And loved every minute of that, every minute. It was just a wonderful opportunity. I made the mistake of thinking, well, if I love that, I'd love Congress. It's just it's just the same. It's right. It's an elected office.
Identical, yeah.
So when Jason Chaffetz resigned, I jumped in and ran for his seat and have been doing that for the last 7 years.
Awesome.
Well, let me ask you. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I did. I skipped over too quickly. 6 children. Okay. And expecting our 17th grandchild. And that's obviously a big part of my life. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you just on the subject of Congress, and then we'll get back maybe to your personal life. What surprised you most about Congress when you
came? You know, when I first came, people would ask me all that time. And I'd say, well, that there are actually a lot of good people here. Because the narrative is the swamp, a bunch of crazy people. But the reality of it is there's just a lot of good people. And that was usually followed with, well, if there are a lot of good people, why aren't you getting anything done? And my response to that was, have you ever been part of an HOA?
So Congress is a great big HOA.
It's a big, and you know what? We struggle to govern ourselves, even in a little neighborhood HOA, right? It's not easy to govern.
Yeah.
Well, so tell me something about Congress that most people wouldn't know. Something that like most people think it's a certain way, but it actually is something very different.
Well, you know, I think probably along those same lines is that we do actually get a lot done. We pass a number of bills, a substantial number of bills. Just last night, we passed a nuclear package. I had a bill in that. And my guess is you won't read about that in the newspaper. Right. And that's what's really, you can imagine the frustration is this was a pretty big deal for energy, for rural Utah, for energy independence, and it passed through the House. And hardly makes the news, if even at all.
Yeah, you're right. I've heard nothing about that.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense of what it is that, like, how it, what determines what makes the news and what doesn't make the news?
Well, unfortunately, it has to, right? It has to be drama. It has to be controversy to make the news. So if I stand out on the Capitol steps and I scream and holler at my colleagues and call them idiots, I'm going to make the news. And if I actually get along and we get something done, then that doesn't make the news. And you can imagine, you know, that's super frustrating from our perspective.
I have noticed that there are people in Congress who do exactly what you just described. They stand out and shout Is that helpful to them in some way? Is there some benefit to that?
Well, I like to say a lot that we reward the wrong behavior here. It's helpful in the sense that that gets them on TV. It helps with fundraising. They go back home and everybody thinks they're a hero. And they really just, you know, it's frustrating because they never really accomplish anything. And the people that are really, you know, doing the hard work and the heavy lifting pretty much go unnoticed.
You know, Congressman, you strike me as like a happy guy, like a fun, good sense of humor. Is your job fun?
So, I'm absolutely convinced that whatever job we have, you find what you look for, right? So, if you wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to have fun today, I'm going to enjoy my work, you do. And if you wake up and say, oh, it's going to be a terrible day, it is. And, you know, my job's like everybody else's. There's good and there's bad. And it depends on what you focus on, I think. So, there is a lot of good in what I do, a lot of good people. And I like to focus on that.
So you kind of represent this sort of contrast that I hear a lot about in America of like, we really like small business owners and the entrepreneurial spirit, and we really hate career politicians. And I wonder if you could help our audience understand how those two kind of work together. Are they really opposite? Are they really opposing things? What are the strengths and weaknesses?
You know, I was always one of those that said, you know, I hate career politicians. I would never be. And all of a sudden, you know, I've been mayor now for 8 years and Congress for 7. And I am one of them, I guess. And I think it's important, like, here again, just like you find what you look for, I think it's not just automatically bad to be here a long time. It can be bad to be here a long time. And if you get caught up in it, and if it becomes too much of who you are, and you get too tied to lobbying groups, I mean, there's a number of things that can go bad when somebody's here a long time. But I don't think it automatically means that it's bad to be here a long time. And, you know, you can point to some really good examples. You know, Senator Orrin Hatch, people talk all the time about how he could simply make a phone call and get things done. So if you brought him any problem in Utah, he'd make a phone call and it would, you know, he could get it done. Well, that's pretty valuable for the state. And that doesn't happen, you know, without his decades and decades of service. And on the other hand, you know, I left being mayor after 8 years, even though I loved it, because I knew that a fresh pair of legs, a fresh perspective was going to be good for the city. And so, you know, those two contrasting points. And I think, you know, those of us that are here just have to be super careful to make sure that we're here, that we're, you know, one of the litmus tests for me is, do I still get excited when I walk in the door? Are there still things for me to do? Am I still running at full speed? I think those are how you determine if you've been here too long.
Yeah. And you know, it does seem like you could say career politician, but this is really something that you took on after you had a full career, which I can kind of understand. I mean, I spent my younger life raising kids and staying at home, and now I teach high school. And for me, having that earlier experience made me better at what I'm doing now. But also a shift later in life, honestly, it gives you new momentum and new, I don't know, energy and vigor.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I don't identify myself as a politician to me. I would say I'm a businessman. And yet, you know, well, I've now been here long enough that I can see why people would identify me as a politician. But that's a really good point, is I had a pretty long and lengthy career before I came here.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us about that, about being a businessman?
Well, I loved it. It's kind of my DNA. And when I think about not being here, that's what, you know, I think, wow, that's what I would love to do. And we had a small business, and it was like many small businesses. It was hard work, right? Like, we worked every day to keep the lights on. And I think more people that come to Washington should have had, you know, I wish they'd had that experience of realizing just how hard it is for small businesses to keep the lights on, to make payroll. I remember my partners putting me on a plane and sending me across the country and asking a customer to pay us so that I could fly back and make payroll. And I think more people should have that experience. And, you know, we worked hard and we worked long hours. Every year we'd put our home up as collateral, me and my partners. And I think people don't really appreciate what you do, you know, as a small business owner. And then when you have some measure of success, the government's pretty quick to want to take it away. Right. And people are critical, right, if you did too well. And we see that all the time. And yet that's what makes, you know, the wheels of our economy go around, are people who are willing to do that type of work and take that type of risk. And we need more of that here in D.C. Too many of my colleagues haven't been through that. And so it's easy to regulate. It's easy to tax if you haven't been through that.
Well, so I'd like to get a little more biographical, if that's okay.
Sure.
So I'm really curious about how your mission in Taiwan shaped your life afterwards.
Well, it massive, right? In so many ways. And I think most people that have been out doing that and now remember, this is 1979 in Taiwan. Taiwan was actually under martial law when I served there as a missionary. And a foreign language back then. We didn't call home every Monday. We didn't even call it Christmas and Mother's Day. I literally went 2 years without anything. Yeah. But you know,
and maybe, mail took forever to get.
So mail would take. Work. Yeah, it would take sometimes 8 weeks if I'd send a letter, wait for a response for that letter to come back. And every once in a while, the big deal is my family would record on a little cassette tape and send me a cassette tape. And so you really learn independence. You learn to thrive on how hard you work. And you, in my case, I learned to love hard work and the satisfaction that came out of working hard. It's a very low baptizing mission. I think my first month we baptized about four, and that was somewhat what we would baptize every month as a mission there. And it wasn't unusual to have missionaries come and spend their whole 2 years and not really experience a baptism, but that doesn't mean we didn't have good experiences, right? And I was fortunate to have some, but and you learn how to live with another guy in an apartment of 2 hours away from everybody else and deal with those issues, and of course the depth of testimony that you build through that experience is so valuable as life's vicissitudes come at you later on. And also that, yes, I made it through that very difficult time. I can make it through this time. You'll get a kick out of this. I remember this moment on my mission. The mission president, when we arrived, he'd give us a little book to keep notes in, and it was framed with this kind of little metal frame that went around it. And I'd been in the island just about 2 months, and I was sitting at my desk, and I looked at my book, and it was shiny. And I looked over at my companion's book, and it had rust on it. And I thought, oh, I'll never get to the point that's so far away when my book actually, because it was very humid over there, where my book actually gets rust. And sure enough, not long later, I'm sitting up there with a rusty book right on the shelf, and somehow that time passes.
Well, so, I've got a couple of follow-ups for you.
Sure.
First of all, I want to know if you have been able to keep up on the language and use it at all. But second of all, I really am interested if we can do an old Saturday's Warrior throwback. Did your wife wait for you? Did she wait for you?
So I'll answer that one first. I think the reason it worked is she kind of waited. We wrote, she dated with other people, and I think that was the first wise decision we made. It's to not really try to go 2 years right without dating. So, but we did write. As a matter of fact, we started writing about once a month, and by my end of my mission, we were writing once a week, and so that the relationship actually progressed, and it worked. If that makes sense. So the language is
okay. Just yeah. One more pause. How long after you got back were you married?
We were married approximately a year after I got back, and so she had dated, of course, and I had not dated for 2 years. So I thought, well, I need to, to look around. And every date I would go on, all I could think about was my wife, right? Of course, she wasn't my wife at the time. And it was like, well, this is silly. Like, everybody I'd go out with, I'd just compare them to her. And, yep. And they didn't stack up. And so it didn't take long before we determined that we wanted to get married. And it's been 41 years. And
that's
been
awesome.
Amazing 41 years, yeah.
And just quick on that, did your mission president counsel you to get married as soon as you could?
I didn't have that counsel. But, it's interesting. I had two mission presidents. I love them both. The first one, I was at a event for being a congressman several weeks ago, and in walked my first mission president with his wife.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah.
I hadn't seen him for years. And our mission's a little different. We haven't done as well with reunions because the mission was formed right as I arrived, and then they consolidated not long after I left. And so we haven't done as well with reunions. And it was just really fun after, 40 years or something to see them. And of course, they looked well and brought back a lot of memories.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So, pivot to the language.
Okay. So, you know, another thing when you asked what I learned is that the Chinese language is difficult. And as a young man, I learned that I could memorize very well and study. And when I was in the MTC, we put headphones on, not too different that I'm wearing, but of course not the microphone. And we would sit in a room and we would memorize all day long. And then the next day we would come into that room and we would memorize. And you just try to memorize these pages of text with these sounds that you had never heard before. And then remember what you had memorized the day before. And I actually had a real aptitude for it. And but I got to the island and I had all this up in my head. And I walked off the plane. And the first thing I said to the customs person that I met there, the immigration person, was "Ni hao," which is a simple hello. And I'll never forget, she said, "Huh?" and because of the tone, the you know, just everything and the accent, she couldn't understand a simple hello. So of course it took months to get, you know, all of that was in my head out in a way that I could communicate. And really loved learning the Chinese language. It's a difficult language, but once you reach a certain point, it kind of builds on itself, if that makes sense, and you can learn it much quicker. I came home. I didn't do much to keep it up. And after I'd been home, gosh, probably 25 years, I went back to China and was so disappointed in my ability to remember it that I came home and started taking weekly lessons and had somebody that would tutor me every week. And I probably got back to about 70-80% of where I was on my mission. And now I go through streaks, particularly if I have a trip over to Taiwan coming up, then I'll really dig in. And it takes just a little while to pick up that, like, that I can say it without doing a lot of thinking. And it's certainly not at the level it was of my mission, but it's pretty good. Mm-hmm.
I know Matt served in the Ukraine, and just throughout his life, he's had such a strong connection to those people and a love for those people. And I'm sure that's the same with you. And I wonder if, like, your affection for those people and your understanding of their culture, if that's had impact on your politics at all.
Absolutely. And particularly given kind of the aggressive dominance of China towards Hong Kong and Taiwan. And, you know, I want to be clear, I love all Chinese people in China, in Hong Kong and Taiwan, but the Chinese dictatorship government and I have hit heads a number of times. So much so that there's actually a warrant for my arrest over in Hong Kong by the Chinese government because of legislation I've passed pushing back on their aggressive takeover of Hong Kong and what they want to do in Taiwan. So it has shaped a big role, and I find myself a defender for Taiwan here in Congress, which they need, quite frankly. And here again, I'll double down. It's not the Chinese that I have the problem with, but the dictatorship there that's actually hard on their own people, even in China.
That does remind me that Melissa was telling me that there was something to do with the Temu Super Bowl ad. Yeah. what is it, Melissa, about that?
I've only seen clips on Instagram because I'm really good at getting my news from good sources. Come on, you'll have to tell us.
Yeah, so after the Super Bowl, my team was like kind of grumpy because Temu is kind of the Amazon of China. And there's nothing wrong with that. But they haven't done a good job to police and patrol products that are sold with slave labor. There's a group in China called the Uyghurs. And in that region, there's terrible atrocities towards the Uyghurs from the Chinese government. The Biden and Trump administration have both called it genocide. And so when I saw their ads on the Super Bowl, I thought, you know what, there's no way they should be able to advertise here in the United States if they're not controlling human rights violations. And I don't want people to think, oh, I'm getting a good deal on this, which they can do, and not know that
that's what they're contributing to.
They're contributing to that. And so that's a kind of an example of us taking, like, yeah, no, we're not going to allow that to happen. So
is that an official bill that we've
introduced it, and it has not yet, we haven't brought it to a vote yet. Just it was only after the Super Bowl that we realized, right, this was a problem.
Yeah.
And the good news is even introducing it has helped bring the attention to it, that we just want consumers to be aware and to make a good decision, and not knowing that there are likely human rights violations is a huge problem, and you can see why.
So pivoting to a different subject, I watched Orrin Hatch's funeral, and I had a conversation one time with the late Senator Bennett about how they would use, so as an official representative in the House of Representatives or as a senator, they were often traveling the world. They were often meeting with a lot of people who aren't members of the church. And there's a lot of stories about how Harry Reid would teach a first discussion to the president of Ecuador, or Orrin Hatch would do some kind of missionary work to staffers on DC. I wonder, is that a thing of the past, or are members of the church still doing that kind of stuff?
No, it's not. Now, I do regret that we're kind of at a record low number of members of the church that actually serve in both the House and the Senate. But it's certainly not a thing of the past. It's near impossible to travel the world and be from Utah and have somebody not know about our faith. And oftentimes I'm traveling with my wife, and she loves to point out how, like, nearly every president that we have met with, first thing they'll do is talk about our temples, and they'll talk about our people and talk about our missionaries. And those conversations come up quite naturally. I've also found from time to time, under the right circumstances, a very unusual, I'll call it a miracle, unfold, where I have a chance to do some good for the church, sometimes in legislative issues around the world. And it's been very clear to me that if I'm paying attention, that those opportunities will come, and I'll be able to have a very positive influence on the work around the world.
So is that kind of the way most things happen in church, where a person just feels prompted or feels inspired? Or is there something more formal or official that makes something like that happen?
You know, I'd say it's a little bit unscripted, primarily because the church is incredibly careful with stepping in. Sometimes I'll have to actually prompt them to tell me what they need when I'm going to a specific country, because I think there's just a huge amount of respect for the church, not from the church's perspective, of not interfering at a level that's inappropriate. And I think sometimes they may even, just to make sure they're not close to the line, stay far away from it, if that makes sense. And so sometimes I'll prompt them and ask them, okay, what can I do if I'm over in this country? And they're happy to tell me.
Well, that's kind of cool and kind of interesting. Like, how much of a direct line do you actually have to church leaders?
There are people who, look, I could pick up the phone call and make a phone call to lots of people within the church about, like, the missionary program, right? Or the temple. And I would be very careful to pull out my phone and call, somebody very high up in the church hierarchy, just because I have so much respect for that. But I think that if it was important, that they would take my call and they would welcome my call. And I would say on rare occasions, that's actually been the case.
Yeah, that's fun.
Do you have any missionary stories you can share with us?
Well, I'll tell you probably the one that was most significant for me and my wife is we were visiting Rwanda. And before we had gone over there, we'd asked the church, you know, what help they need. And they told us about a law that had been passed in Rwanda that said that you had to have a college degree to be a pastor or a bishop over a congregation. And Rwanda was trying to protect their people, because people were coming into the country and scamming. They set up a church and scam the people in Rwanda. So that was their response, is, okay, well, we're going to put a kind of a filter on there to make sure that doesn't happen. But you can imagine, in the case of the church, if every branch president had to have a college degree, there's a lot of places in the world where that would be, you know, near impossible. And we found out that was the situation, and didn't know if we'd have a chance to talk about it. But as we got to Rwanda, there was a dinner with the president canceled, and then he called last minute and reinstated the dinner. And you need to understand that everything that happens in Congress is by seniority. So when we sit on an airplane, like the first row goes to the most senior member, right? When we speak, we speak in a speaking order of senior to junior.
Wow.
I mean, everything is seniority based. And I was the youngest in seniority on the trip. And so I thought, well, gosh, how am I even going to have a chance to talk to the president? And as we walked into the room and to sit at the tables, they were round tables and they had name tags on them. And my wife and my name were on the president's table with the Attorney General of Rwanda, the President of Rwanda, and his wife, and the senior most member of the delegation, and then my wife and I, who are the youngest, and we had a chance for an hour to explain how that law impacted our church and why that was a problem for us to both the president and the Attorney General. And that just doesn't, I mean, that seating arrangement just doesn't happen, right, without some type of intervention. And so I think that's a really good example of when I say, look, you know, if you look for those windows and if you're ready for them, they'll present themselves.
Yeah. I notice that you, a lot of times when you're telling your stories, you say we, and I want to know, is we you and your wife? Is it you and your team? Like, how involved is your wife in your day-to-day work?
Yeah, I think we is an attempt by me to defer, like, this really is a team. No, yeah, really is a team, right, okay. Effort. And I'm always uncomfortable saying, I did this, right? I passed this bill. And so I think the we sometimes refers to the team. And I have a team here in Washington, D.C. I have a team in Utah. I have a campaign team. And I have a family team. And the we could really be any one of those. My wife, I'm really blessed with a wife who walks a very, very difficult line of being there, being supportive, but not interfering. And you can imagine that that's a fine line. And so she, you know, yesterday I had not been home for 4 days. I ran in the house. I had 5 minutes and I took out the dirty clothes out of my suitcase and put the clean ones in and ran out the door. And she gave me a kiss and doesn't complain. Right. It's just super supportive. And I'm just really blessed with not just a wife, but a family who's very, very supportive.
That's awesome. And six kids.
Six amazing kids. They're the best. And we're expecting our 17th grandchild. And, you know, those are my happiest moments when I get to spend time with them.
Yeah.
So go ahead, Melissa.
Go ahead, Matt.
So your life kind of spans this change in the church from a Utah-centric church to a global organization. And I wonder if you could give us some perspective on how you think the church has changed as a result of becoming a global organization and what changes you think might be positive or what changes you might think are maybe negative. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think if you look at the diversity in church leadership, you'll see that worldwide influence, and I think that's incredibly positive. I think what's stunning is that the church is able to keep the consistency that they keep, not only over time, but over geographic locations where it's so predictable. If you walk into a sacrament meeting, right, in Taiwan, and you walk into one in Provo, Utah, you know exactly what's coming, right? You know, right? And it's just really stunning how well they're able to keep, you know, the basics exactly the same. But I also think, you know, President Nelson's just a fabulous example of separating out, you know, habits from doctrine. And, you know, I think some of that worldwide influence too has been helpful to really challenge, is this doctrine or is this a habit? Do we do this by habit or is it really doctrine? And it's always kind of fun every time President Nelson will challenge one of those paradigms, right? And people realize, well, I thought it had to be that way. And all of a sudden, no, it doesn't really have to be that way.
Yeah, I love that too. Go ahead, Matt.
No, go ahead.
Well, I'm going to ask a question that has nothing to do with anything we've talked about. Okay. Okay. But I'm just wondering, like, as a person, like for me, there's certain things that I do every single day that are important to just kind of maintaining who I am as a person.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I eat, I sleep, I go to the Maverick and get a Diet Dr. Pepper. Like, those are some of the important things. And I'm just wondering for you, what are the things you do every single day?
Yeah, so there are absolutely some routines, and that's one of the ways you survive this job. For me, it's working out. This week, I actually missed 2 days, and I probably haven't missed 2 days in 2 years. But it was just the nature of the traveling. So I really try 6 days a week to get a good, not just a workout, but a good workout. And that's my therapy. And then I would say the second thing is as close as I can to eating healthy. I couple of protein shakes. So I try to, and that's difficult too with travel. The number of times when I eat a meal that I didn't prepare, like somebody's always setting something in front of me, right? So that's a challenge. But I would say those are my two like go-to things.
Yeah. What's a workout? Are you a runner? You look like you might be a runner.
I do enjoy running. I think, you know, one of my favorite things to do is when I'm here in Washington, I'll get out and run down the mall past the Washington Memorial to the Lincoln Memorial and back up to the Capitol. And then at home, I actually have a route where I go out of my home and around the Provo Temple twice and back home. And then I like to try to lift a couple of days as well a week.
And is there a gym there in the in Congress?
There is. It's in the basement of this building that I'm in. And we're always very quick to point out that we pay a fee. It's not a perk. We pay a membership to use it. And the equipment's pretty old. But what's interesting is there's actually better camaraderie in the House gym than I think anywhere that you'll find between members of the same party and members of different parties. It really breaks down, you know, a lot of barriers. And I think it's an incredibly healthy thing for us to be in that environment together.
It is interesting how the world perception, the perception from the outside of Congress is this divisive, hateful, mean place. But what you're describing is something much more collegial and much more.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's far more of us that like each other than that don't. And, you know, just this morning I was down there and probably a half a dozen of my Democratic colleagues asked me how my race was going and how my family was and you know, vice versa. And it's really does break down a lot of barriers when you're in that environment. And I think when we travel, that's also something that happens. If you spend a week traveling with somebody, you really get to know them. And during COVID, that was one of the things that people I don't think realized was a real problem is we weren't traveling together. We weren't even voting together. When we go out and vote, there's 435 of us out on the floor talking, and for several years that didn't happen. And I think that people underestimate how big of an impact that was.
So one question I like to ask everybody is an interesting sacrament meeting or church experience, not like a spiritual one, but we all kind of have these like things that happened in church that you say, oh my heavens, how did that happen in church today?
So that's good. Well, without much time to think, for some reason, my mind flashed back to a story my dad told about me. And in the old church chapels, they didn't have carpet. And I had brought a marble to church and dropped it. And everybody heard it roll all the way from across the bottom underneath everybody's feet on this wood floor all the way across.
And, hilarious. Yeah, my mom's story about me is one time apparently I was being bad in church, and so she was taking me out. And as she was walking me out of the chapel, I started screaming, "Mom, please don't beat me. Please don't beat me." Yeah.
A little passive aggressiveness there for the
yeah. You know, I do think that one of the things that I love about our church is that we are put into these local communities that we don't choose. And it forces us to get to know people that we might not have gotten to know otherwise.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I wonder in your current job, like how much time do you get to connect with everyday ordinary people and kind of talk to them and learn what's going on?
That's a good question. And I think in addition to kind of a lack of time, if not careful, there's a little barrier there. I think, you know, sometimes people are uncomfortable to talk to me, and I sense that. And, you know, when I go to church, I have to have the realization that not everybody in that room agrees with me. Sure. And you know, are they looking at me as John Curtis, the neighbor? Or are they looking at me as John Curtis, the guy who I differ with his policies? And so, you know, you have to, I think, work hard to break down those barriers. We moved just about a year and a half ago. And had we still been in the ward where people knew me right before I got into politics, I think that would have been a lot easier. Mm-hmm. But coming into a new ward where you don't know people as well, I think it's always a challenge. But people are super, and we've got a great, great ward, and we love them all.
Yeah. Do you have a church calling? Are you able to do that?
So they just gave me a church calling, and before in the other ward it was gospel doctrine, which I loved.
Yeah.
But the reality of it too is, you know, and the bishop and I have talked about this. If you're going to call me to gospel doctrine, and I'm standing up in front of people, am I causing a bad experience for anybody because they can't separate me from my my political views. And so, you know, I worry about that. But so the bishop just gave me a call and he said, my job is to take people to the temple with me when I go. Yeah. So
that's so great.
That's my calling. And this last Saturday, my wife and I invited a woman who I barely knew. She's 92 years old. And she went with us. And it, by the way, it was the last day the Provo Temple was open before the remodel. Okay. And so I got to know her. It was a great experience.
Oh, I love that. I think that's a great fit. Yeah.
Yeah. So I got to know, what do you feel about the change of the Provo Temple, the new design?
So I'm super conflicted. Yeah. Right. Like, I was one who years ago said, oh, I hate the thing. Yeah. And, you know, and then as Ogden got torn down, it became far more iconic.
Yeah.
And it there's some iconicness that will be missed, I think, with that building. It clearly was built for efficiency. And so I'm sure we'll love the new design, but we'll miss the old one too.
Yeah. Have you seen the renderings for the new design? It's actually really pretty. And they're changing the name to Rock Canyon.
Rock Canyon. Rock Canyon. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for those who don't know where that temple is, it back behind it, if you stand in front of it, you see Rock Canyon, and it is spectacular. I mean, it is, there's probably a few temples with a better background than that temple. And one of my favorite places to go is up Rock Canyon, right behind it. And so if you're not familiar with it, come see it and then go up Rock Canyon.
Are you a climber? Do you climb in Rock Canyon?
I don't climb, but I hike. I love to hike. And going back to when I was mayor, that canyon was a big deal. It was under controversy. It was in the opening of it was in private hands. And I was actually part of the city buying that. And so there's a lot of meaning to me just being in that canyon.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything else you want to share with our listeners before we end?
Well, it's just been a delight to be with you, and you've asked great questions. You've probably learned a lot more about me than I had intended to share.
Good.
And so I hope it's been good for you as well.
It's been wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Listener, have a great week.